Blog Talk Radio. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. All right. Welcome, everybody. This is Down and Out Radio. This is Mike Sledge on the Renegade Broadcasting Network, the best goddamn network in internet radio. All right? That's all I'm going to say. Thanks for tuning in. We do have a chat room. You want to go to the chat room and hang out with people and, you know, diss me and talk shit or share ideas, you can go to renegadebroadcasting.com and everything pops up. Our archives for all the shows in the network, the chat room, everything. Everything is right there. It is user friendly. And this is Jew Free Radio. This is Down and Out Radio with Mike Sledge. My guest tonight will be Dave from Texas. The history of slavery in the United States will be the topic. And that was the intro. That's Dave from Texas' theme song every time he comes on now. It is a full moon tonight as well. Every time he comes on, it is a full moon. So if you listening don't like that, you can go to hell. That's all I got to say about that. Oh, by the way, before I bring Dave on, let me just say this. Unlike most of these truther radio fags who want to do organic gardening and talk about rutabagas and beets and melons for 2 hours, I want to talk about how, you know, in this studio, in the Black Pope studio, next to the Black Pope throne right now, okay, is a hot chick, a hot woman. And just to prove that this is not rent-a-gay radio, this is renegade, we actually have real hot chicks in the studio sometimes. Would you like to say hello to the world here?
Hello, everybody.
Yes. So, yeah, that's how we roll here at Renegade. We don't have Jufros and have men in the studio talking about goddamn organic rutabagas. We're going to be talking about the history of slavery, how we're getting screwed, how our culture's getting fucked, how our heritage is going down the toilet, all on the Black Pope throne with Dave from Texas, with a beautiful woman riding shotgun by my side while I drink 13th Colony Vodka. All right? Let's get right to this. Let me bring Dave from Texas on here, okay? All right. Let me bring Dave from Texas on here.
I'm here.
All right. Let's do this, man. Let's tear this up, man. Welcome to Down and Out Radio. And by the way, Dave will be on a new show coming to the network soon on Sundays. And so welcome aboard, my friend.
Thank you very much. One thing I'd like to talk about before we actually get started on slavery, if I could, there was a topic in the amongst several people last Friday night that was being discussed that had to do with duality.
Mm-hmm.
And being an occultist, I'd like to kind of throw in my two cents here on this.
Okay.
If I could.
Sure.
Bear with me a little bit, and let me give you a little intro information, and then you'll see how it relates to it when I get to the end of it. I'm going to use astrology as an example. Okay, you have 12 signs, and you have 12 houses. Take a circle and divide it into 12 pieces. Pretend it's a pizza.
Okay.
And you have an order of signs: Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, et cetera, on down the line. And then you would have first house, second house, third house, fourth house. Okay, well, each sign in each house has a polarity assigned to it. So you start with positive. So the first one is positive, second one is negative, third one is positive, fourth one is negative, and so on and so forth. And then when it gets on down around the circle, then you start having opposition positions. For example, the first house is opposed to the seventh. The second house is opposed to the eighth. The third is opposed to the ninth, and so forth. So what you have is opposites. You have polarity. Now, envision trying to start a car with a negative cable to your battery disconnected. It ain't going to start. Okay? So what you have is positive and negative duality, but that does not mean that negative is bad just because something is a negative polarity. All right, so if male is positive, female is negative, we're certainly not going to say our women are negative, are we, in a bad way, right? No.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so what you're really talking about here and what this conversation ultimately was really about has to do with life and anti-life. You take the word live, and then you reverse that word, and you get evil. So therefore, the word evil becomes the opposite of life. So what we're really dealing with people, is a group of people who are anti-life. It's the Hegelian dialectic. And so you have to have positive and negative in everything. Now, you also have to have good and bad. But is bad necessarily evil? Let's say I break into your house and I steal something. Well, was that really evil? Well, maybe, you know, kind of. So, you know, evil may be some sort of a measurement of bad, yes, in a certain sense. But, you know, that's certainly bad, so it's not good. But the point being is that evil is a certain level of bad that it becomes anti-life, okay? And that's what you're really looking at. Now, Christianity really has a mono viewpoint in that, so one day, you know, there will be no bad and no evil, et cetera, all is going to be good. Well, that just can't quite happen that way. just the laws of the universe is going to define that there's a positive and negative and everything. But you can have a society where you don't have any anti-life, okay?
Yeah, and I'd like to say this, Dave. You know, when the Christianity talks about having one day they'll be all good, their version of good is really anti-life because their whole religion is based upon a sacrifice.
Exactly.
So only through death can you be saved. And we're saying is no. You don't have to. You don't have to die to be saved. Live, enjoy your life, have a good time. You don't have to be brought down by these anti-life vampires.
And you're never going to be perfect either.
Right. No.
So. Well, anyway, I just wanted to bring that up because that got a little heated, and I thought, well,
sure.
You're missing my input here. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I was trying to really say there was not really so much for the negative polarity versus the positive polarity. I was talking about how they use that concept, how a certain group of people, how elite Jews use that concept to hide behind as a cloak to justify their anti-life behavior on this planet. That's basically what I was trying to say.
So then what you're saying is that they're mixing life, anti-life, into polarity in order to confuse the issue.
Sure, absolutely.
There we have it clarified.
Just like they always do. They always have to bring in something to muddy the waters and to make everything, not to quote Josh Reeves, but to, you know, to bring in something that confuses people and some straw man to hide behind, you know.
Pretty much. Well, I'm ready to dive into this topic if you are.
Absolutely. Slavery. Let's do this.
I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do tonight. I've got a little booklet here that I found over the net that has been floating around for a long time. And it's called Who Brought the Slaves to America? And it's written by a man named Walter White Jr. in 1968. And a lot of people have heard bits and pieces of this. You know, they've all heard the list of the ships and who the Jewish owners are. And that probably even came from this particular little booklet. And but before I get into reading this, and by the way, this is about 14 pages approximately, but I'm not going to read all 14. I'll leave all the credits and stuff out for you.
Mm-hmm.
There's an example letter in here, too, copy of a letter that was that I'm not going to bother to discuss as well. You'll understand what I'm talking about when I get to it. But what I wanted to discuss here is just kind of a timeline, but not a complete timeline. And the reason I say that is because what I'm going to do when I have my own show is I'm going to do a complete racial timeline from the beginning of the Jamestown colony until 1860. But that's too much for a two-hour show. We're going to do the best we can in 2 hours here. What I want to start off with was the original Jamestown settlements. Now, Jamestown was settled in 1607. Now, the Mayflower in Plymouth did not occur until 1620. There's about a 13-year difference there. And the Mayflower was basically a bunch of religious nuts. Okay, Now, I'm not saying they were all bad, you know, just because they were religious. But and by the way, about 10% of the population of the United States claims some sort of descent from the Mayflower.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, one family, and a lot of them had died off. They didn't even survive the first winter. But there was one family who did manage to thrive and had a bunch of children, and so most people have a claim to descending from that voyage over here. But before the Mayflower even arrived on the shore of the American colonies, one year before that, the first presence of what could be called any form of slavery existed in about 1619. But it really wasn't slavery, per se. It wasn't not the way that we know it today. It was the first blacks that came to this country. Of course, it wasn't a country at the time. And what had happened was is they started raising tobacco crops. And tobacco seeds were hard to find. They were considered a commodity. And in Spain, it was against the law to even sell them to anybody without a license. Now, I say that loosely. You had to have permission to get hold of the seeds. Well, some of the people who settled in Jamestown did get hold of tobacco seeds, and they started growing tobacco in Jamestown. And by 1660, that is really when you could truly lay some sort of a claim to slavery beginning what became the colonies. Now, Greg had mentioned in a show that the blacks did come here and they were not slaves at first, and that's very true. They became enslaved. And so you could theoretically use the year 1660 as a definition of when this occurred. Now, there's something else I want to bring up that, and you'll understand why a little bit later, but this is about the city of New Orleans. Now, New Orleans was certainly not any part of the colonies, and it was acquired during the Louisiana Purchase in 1803. Mm-hmm. Louisiana, in particular, the area that is the state, the Louisiana Purchase was a vast territory, but the state is pretty much what we know it today, was a colony of Spain and France at various times. And there was a lot of slaves had been brought in through that port of New Orleans, and I'm not going to be touching on that issue tonight. However, I do want to mention that slavery in the United States was destined to be eliminated in the sense of the importation of slaves. It was set in the Constitution that slavery would be legal for, I think, 20 years. And the importation stopped in the year 1808. And at that time, that certainly did not stop the importation of slaves. There was plenty of smuggling. Mm-hmm. And New Orleans was not part of the United States until 1804. I think the purchase was 1803. But we didn't really take over the territory until about another year later. And so there's a four-year period there where it did belong to the United States, but it was an unorganized territory. Louisiana did not become a state until 1812. Just a little tidbit of information. That's really the first instance of a truly multicultural society in this country, because you had Spanish, you had French, you had blacks. There were even Indians that were civilized in the area. Let me give you an example. During the Battle of 1812, when Andrew Jackson gave his orders out, they were issued in four languages: Spanish, French, English, and some dialect of one tribe who fought on the side of the Americans against the British. Ironically, there is one language that was conspicuously missing: Hebrew or Yiddish. There were no Jews fighting in there, so there was no need, or if they were, they spoke English, put it that way. So anyway, I just kind of wanted to make that point there. But we're not really going to discuss New Orleans too much. However,
I will say this, Dave, that New Orleans was actually, a lot of people talk about New York and Chicago, New Orleans actually the whole La Kosher Nostra and the mob actually got their stranglehold there in the beginning before they moved on to New York and Chicago and all that, which is very interesting as well.
That's true, very true. And also that's of significance is that New Orleans was the busiest port in, I guess, probably the North American continent, even before it was acquired by the United States. New York did not become the largest port in this country until after the completion of Erie Canal, which was in 1825, and that was hand dug from Lake Erie all the way to the Hudson River. And most of the population in New York, aside from New York City, lives along the canal and the Hudson in that path. And Wall Street and the Erie Canal allowed for New York to eventually become the largest port. But until then, New Orleans was. And if you even today, New Orleans is still a major port. New York is considered to be the largest port in this country. It alternates between Houston and New Orleans as to which is the second busiest in tonnage. And Houston leads every year in importations, of imports. But total tonnage is always usually New York. But anyway, that's kind of beside the point. Mm-hmm. But up that river was a town called Natchez, Mississippi. And I'll get to that in just a second. But first thing I want to do is I want to discuss I just want to give everybody a brief description of a plantation at the time of the American colonies, just mm-hmm. to kind of so you can get a picture in your mind. Now, this was still living under British rule. The plantations became very important to the southern colonies. And they grew other cash crops as well, obviously, like hemp. And, of course, there's hemp, tobacco, rice, sugar, and cotton. Just break it down as those were the major ones. But they were those were not the only ones. The first plantations were usually built along a river. The river was used as a highway to transport crops to market and goods to the plantation. Plantations on a river had their own dock for loading and uploading boats. Plantations that were not on a river were connected by roads to another plantation. The main building of the plantation was the planter's house. Servants and slaves lived nearby in small buildings. Kitchens were usually in a separate building because of the danger of fire. Crops were stored in sheds, and the livestock were kept in barns. Plantations were totally self-sufficient. Each plantation, for example, each plantation had its own blacksmith shop, laundry, etc. Money was rarely used in the southern colonies. Crops were traded. Crop buyers traveled up and down southern waterways with their boats filled with British-made goods. Planters would trade their tobacco, rice, etc., for goods such as shoes, lace, thread, farm tools, dishes, and so on. The very large plantations did not sell their own crops. Planters of very large plantations sold their crops through a broker in Britain. Now, I want people to pay attention to that word broker, because if you're going to be listening to any of my shows later down the line, I'm going to discuss that word in more detail and how that will relate to the topic that I will be discussing at the time. Now, back to the other issues here. In the United States, this is just kind of general information here. The Founding Fathers believed that slavery would soon disappear on its own accord, and they had every reason to believe that.
Mm-hmm.
However, in 1794, there was an invention called a cotton gin by a man named Eli Whitney.
Right.
Before the cotton gin, when you harvested cotton, you had to pick all the seeds out of it before it could be used, and that had to be done by hand. And it took forever to do. I mean, one slave might do 1 pound a day. Well, that's not going to go very far trying to reach a large market. But the cotton gin allowed hundreds of pounds to be de-seeded daily. Now, the invention of the cotton gin is also rather interesting because that allowed for the cotton industry to just take off like crazy. By the time By 1830, the United States had 50% of the world's cotton of the market. And then by 1850, it sold 75% of the world's cotton. Now, that's a huge portion. Now, they also had competition from the southern hemisphere. You know, there was plenty of other plantations going on in the Caribbean and South America by the other European powers. But, again, we're not talking specifically about those, and I don't want to drift off too far in that direction.
Sure, sure.
Now, what this allowed to do, the cotton gin, was allow people to start wearing pre-manufactured clothes. Until that time, everybody made their own clothes. And when the cotton gin came into being, this also allowed for patterns to be made, and so people could put these clothes together. Now, every one of us right now are listening to the sound of my voice on some form of a computer, whether it's being streamed or whatever the case may be. The origins of the modern computer actually came from the cotton gin. Punch cards were created in order to allow for a system to be created so different colors of threads could be separated in a manufacturing process.
Mm-hmm.
The cotton gin was actually what created what we know in the United States as our original industrial revolution. Up north,
yep.
Textile manufacturers, and if you don't know what textiles are, it's basically clothes. Clothes, cloth, linen, etc. Textile manufacturers took off big time. So we had a huge industry in the north. Profits made from that led to creations of other industries, other investments in other ways. You understand capitalism, okay? So
let me just say that influx of carpetbaggers, the Jew carpetbaggers from the north actually made their journey down to Savannah, Georgia here, and they slowly began to consolidate their power in the cotton industry here in Georgia, which is really interesting. And that's why you still see in Savannah today, Dave, a huge Jewish population.
No surprise. No surprise.
Yeah. It was it was the home of the first textile plant here in Georgia, Savannah.
Now, what the textile plant also allowed to happen was for women to actually start moving into the workplace. So this is your first instance in history where women have actually started to hold jobs. And, of course, these were the original sweatshops.
Mm-hmm.
And these existed well into the beginning of the 20th century. So you see how big this industry became when the United States had 75% of the cotton market. Now, what this allowed to happen was the creation of millionaires. And the largest concentration of millionaires in the world at this time were in Natchez, Mississippi. And Natchez, Mississippi is roughly about 85 miles north of Baton Rouge. If you look on a map, it's in the southwest corner of Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And there was that was the largest concentration of plantations in the South. One plantation was over 40,000 acres, and that is three times, to give you an idea of what that is, it's three times the size of Manhattan.
Wow.
This is huge. And wherever there is money to be made, there are Jews. There was a population of Jews in Natchez,
mm-hmm.
just like Mike has discussed before in other shows about there being a Jewish population in Charleston.
Mm-hmm.
You know, however, the volume of the population was not really significant as a whole, whether it be in the South or in the United States. When Jews first started coming to this country, their main port of entry was Charleston, and over time it shifted.
Mm-hmm.
In the year 1860, there were only 700 Jews living in Charleston, and there were 40,000 Jews living in New York City. So that gives you an example of how things shifted because of the Industrial Revolution. Now,
let me say, it's still shifting today, Dave. They keep on coming down here.
I know. It's sad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, not all of these Jews were plantation owners. There were plenty of businessmen. For example, in Natchez, Mississippi, 5% of the, and this is over the whole 1800s, before and after the war, 5% of the population in Natchez, Mississippi was for Jews, and they owned about one-third of the businesses. Now, there are some Jews that every one of us know by name who came from Natchez, Mississippi, who made a killing and went on to other ventures, and those were the Monsanto brothers. They came from Natchez, Mississippi, directly out of the slave industry.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, there were other, you know, there were, you know, wherever there's a population of Jews, just outside the town is where most of these Jewish plantations were. The Jews tend to congregate where there are other Jews. Now, whites did own some plantations as well. That they may or may not have been near some of the Jewish ones. They may have been some of the ones, as I described before, that were connected to another plantation. The road system in the South was not very good. People who had visited the United States and toured the North and then toured the South, their main gripe about being in the South was the lack of a proper road system, and that was certainly a justified comment. So, and again, I'm not trying to in any way defend slavery here. I just want to make sure this is understood. I just want to try and get this information out so everybody has a proper perspective by the time this is all said and done. And
yeah, absolutely. The people trying to defend slavery these days are basically the Jews, man. They're the ones that really were responsible for it, even segregation laws and all that, man. So, I mean, you know,
Segregation laws. I'll go ahead and shed some light on that, too.
Yeah.
Most people may know this, but I'll bring it up again anyway. Most of your original segregation laws actually began in the North when slaves were basically sent down south. A lot of them, there were still some that remained up there, and a lot of whites didn't like the fact that there were still blacks around, and so they started passing laws saying that black people could not live in whatever particular area they had control of the jurisdiction of. And so there were free blacks. And let me give you one example. At the time of the Revolution, 10% of the population of Boston was black.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying they were all free, but there were slaves. Now, there were plenty of white plantation owners. And you mentioned the Jewish ones, but there were plenty of white ones. Let me give you an example. I have a friend whose last name is Ukrainian, and most of his family was concentrated in Alabama. Now, ironically, the same applies to my last name as well. But my friend did some research one time, and by accident discovers that he had an ancestor who owned about 50 black slaves. Now, he was not a large plantation owner, he was a small owner. And so if you look and see the slaves' names, you can tell who the owners of these slaves were. Now, as we know, Jews change their names, so there's times where a name may not appear to have been Jewish, but it was. Or there were plenty of instances where the slaves may not have adopted their master's last names. Nevertheless, I was in a department store in the late 80s here in Houston buying something once. The lady handling my transaction took my credit card, looked at my last name, goes, "Oh, that's my boyfriend's last name." Now, I never even knew we even owned slaves. Now, this is before this mass trend of jungle fever by white women, and so I presume that her boyfriend at that time probably was a black guy. Okay, so you know that was the first instance where I had ever heard of the possibility of my ancestors even owning slaves. No doubt there was not very many because my last name is not very common, and I'm not going to give it out. So, but nevertheless. Now, what I wanted to touch on, too, was where was slavery legal in this country? Now, there was a discussion on Friday night, and Greg and I had discussed some things. And what I had mentioned was that I had seen a chart where there were states indicated were states had slavery and states that didn't have slavery. And there was a few in the North that didn't have it, but there were still some that did. But I can tell you that in the beginning, all of the states were slaveholding states. And the reason I know this is if you do a little research on the state of Vermont. Now, Vermont was not one of the original 13 colonies, and it's sandwiched between New York and New Hampshire. And there was a fighting between New Hampshire and New York as to who owned that land anyway. But Vermont became an independent republic. They had a constitution. They fought with the American colonies against the British. They had no representation in the Continental Congress. They did by proxy through Connecticut, I believe. And they were an independent republic for about 15 years. And they did not participate in the adoption of the Constitution. And they had, again, they had nothing to do with the Articles of Confederation. However, during the time that they were a republic, they outlawed slavery. Now, when Vermont entered the Union, they entered as the 14th state. So that was the first state outside of the original 13. They became the first state that had no slavery in it. Therefore, that by default, all the rest allowed slavery. So anyway, let's see here. Where are we at on the clock?
And I want to say one more thing, a real quick interjection here. A lot of people don't know this. Have you ever heard of Mumba slavery?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was, people don't know that there were blacks here that were actually freed from some of the southern plantations that then went ahead and imported their own black slaves on black plantation property. A lot of people don't know about that. Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up, because I was going to.
Okay. I'm sorry.
That's okay. you saved me a little effort there.
But you never hear that in the movies, right? You know what I mean?
No, you certainly don't. And most of the time, not all the time, but a good portion of the time, where you did have some free slaves, they actually would purchase slaves. There was one instance, and I think it was in South Carolina, where there was a free slave, a woman, who had a small plantation of black slaves. And a white man sued her in court, and I don't remember what the issue was. I read that about 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the white man lost against the black woman in court. Also, I want to bring something else up, too.
And I'm curious if they ever do reparations. I wonder if they're going to go after money from those black plantation owners who have black slaves.
Yeah, that's a good point, very good point. Mm-hmm. Now, there's something else that doesn't get discussed very often, and I don't want to get into this issue of the war between the states tonight, but I do want to say this. During
the War of Northern Aggression Day.
That's true. That's the best description. You're right. Now, Washington, D.C. Was a slave city, so to speak. I'm not going to go through all the southern states where slavery was legal, but I'll go through the border states. Missouri, Kentucky, Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware were slave states at that time, and so therefore Washington, D.C. was a slaveholding territory as well. The Capitol building of the United States has gone through several phases, and it's had three different domes. If you look at the front elevation or the front view of the building, from the older, I'd say pre-Civil War, you'll see three small domes, one larger one in the middle. Well, over time, they decided to take the two domes out on the left and the right and change the one in the middle, and they made it the dome that we see today. During the whole course of the war between the states, slaves built that dome on top of the Capitol building. So there goes one of those arguments that they were fighting for to free the slaves. So let me kind of glance at my notes real here. If you have any comments that you'd like to throw in, Mike, now's a good time, and let me kind of reorganize my notes real quick.
I just think it's funny that through history revisionism, through the Jewish-controlled media and the Jewish-controlled Hollywood, that they brainwashed people into believing that we were the evil people in the world, that white Europeans were evil, the evil people in the world for slavery. That's what they teach everybody. And they never teach the fact that there were black slave owners in the South that actually got, who were actually lighter-skinned blacks who brought in darker-skinned blacks to work on their own pieces of property, small plantations here in the South. That is a fact. Mumbai slavery, look it up. It's very interesting. That was prevalent around the South Carolina area. Also to this fact, that most of the working-class whites in the South were opposed to slavery the same way the blue-collar workers were opposed to NAFTA and GATT today, because the white working-class people worked on some of the big plantations in the South, picking the cotton and all that, and they were feeding their families from that work. When slavery came, it was another form of cheap labor like they're doing today with the Mexicans and Hispanics bringing them in here through the free trade agreements. It was a similar situation then. So actually most of the working class white people of the South were opposed to slavery during those days, which is never talked about. And they've done a very great – and by the way, speaking of slavery today, Africa still has slaves. The more lighter skinned blacks who run African countries, who are financed through the Jews and the IMF and the World Bank, still have the slave trade going there just like they did back then. It hasn't changed. But you never hear this coming from the Jewish-controlled media. You never hear it coming out of Hollywood. You never see movies on this. It's always the evil white Europeans who brought over slaves, They keep repeating the same lie over and over again, and it's done a lot of damage to this country and our heritage. And I think it's a damn shame, and it's not the truth.
Yeah, I'd like to mention something here too.
Mm-hmm.
This is not directly related to what we're talking about. This is just in general. Okay, you listen to a lot of these hosts that talk about, oh, the Jews did this, the Jews did that, and then I hear stuff like, oh, every president was a crypto Jew, and they did this and they did that. Well,
now, wait a minute, Dave. You mean you're talking about the Jews?
Yeah, exactly. Now let me tell you this: if you think that Western civilization was created and run by Jews, then you need to just go crawl under a rock or pull out a pistol and just blow your brains out, because what the hell are we fighting for? Okay? If Jews have been running everything from the beginning of time, and we're just their slaves, and they're just totally behind the scenes directing us, no, wrong, sorry. You may as well just hang it up, call it quits, end, okay?
I agree. Now, they co-opted our stuff, and they've infiltrated through infiltration, and now they're profiting off what they co-opted. They can't come up with an original idea themselves.
Exactly. Now, I've been wanting to say that for a good while. One more thing related to that. You know, I read that letter from the Century Magazine on one of your shows a while back, where the Jews said they were behind every revolution. Well, in a certain way, they may have had some impetus in it, okay, because they had their hands in everything. But did they create that revolution? Probably not, okay? You know, that was a brag letter. And we should certainly say, if you're called an anti-Semite, well, hey, you admit it right here. Let's point to that letter. But don't take it all literally, as they have control over everything. They've only had so much control, okay?
Yep.
So anyhow, let's see here. Where are we at on the clock? 7:45. Okay.
Yeah, we're good, man.
Okay. All right. I wasn't sure how the time factor was going to go with this.
I figured at 9 o'clock we could take a little music break and smoke a cigarette, break at 9 if you want. Or if you want to keep on going straight through, we can do that, man. It's no problem with me, man.
Well, I think we're good on time. So okay. What I'd like to do here is mention one other thing, and I think I can jump into this essay. Britain freed all of their slaves. When I say Britain, that means the whole British Empire in 1840, completely outlawed slavery. And that was 20 years before the beginning of the War of Northern Aggression. I was about to say war between the states again.
Right.
Okay. And so during this time, okay, remember I'd mentioned before that the United States in 1830 had 50% of the world's production of cotton, and then by 1850, 75%. Well, so right there in the middle, Britain outlawed slavery. And so when Britain outlawed slavery, all that did was just help increase the industrial production of it here, a little bit less competition. Now, I'd like to go ahead and get into this essay here. And again, this is Who Brought the Slaves to America by Walter White Jr. in 1968.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the story of the slaves in America begins with Christopher Columbus. His voyage to America was not financed by Queen Isabella of Spain, but by a man named Luis de Santangelo. I'm hoping I'm saying that right.
Yep, the Murano.
Yeah, he advanced the sum of 17,000 ducats, D-U-C-A-T-S. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. Now, that's equal to about 5,000 pounds at the time. Today, that would be, and this is 1968 when he says today, would be about 50,000 pounds. The voyage began on August 3rd, 1492. Columbus was accompanied by five Murano Jews, a Luis de Torres, an interpreter, Marco, the surgeon, Bemmel, the physician, and Alonso de la Calle, and Gabriel Sanchez. Gabriel Sanchez, abetted by the other four Jews, sold Columbus on the idea of capturing 500 Indians and selling them as slaves in Seville, Spain, which was done. Columbus did not receive any of the money from the sale of the slaves, but he became the victim of a conspiracy fostered by Bemmel, the ship's doctor. He, Columbus, suffered injustice and imprisonment as his reward. Betrayed by the five Murano Jews whom he had trusted and helped, this ironically was the beginning of slavery in America. The Jews were expelled from Spain on August 2nd, 1492, and from Portugal in 1497. Many of these Jews emigrated to Holland, which, by the way, I'm interjecting something here. Holland was at one time a colony of Spain, even though it was on the European continent. Not many know that. Many of the Jews emigrated to Holland, where they set up the Dutch West Indies Company to exploit the New World. In 1654, the first Jew, a Jacob Baramson, immigrated from Holland to New Amsterdam, which is now known as New York. And in the new decade, many more followed him. They all settled on the East Coast, principally in New Amsterdam and Newport, Rhode Island. Pay attention to that. They were prevented by ordinances issued by Governor, I can't even pronounce his name, from engaging in the domestic economy. So they quickly discovered that the territory inhabited by the Indians would be a fertile field. There were no laws preventing Jews from trading with the Indians.
Mm-hmm.
The first Jew began trading with the Indians was Haman Levy, who imported cheap glass beads, textiles, earrings, armbands, and other cheap adornments from Holland, which were traded for valuable fur pelts. Haman Levy was soon joined by this other Jew named Nicholas Lowe and Joseph Simon. Lowe conceived the idea of trading rum and whiskey to the Indians and set up a distillery in Newport, where these two liquors were produced. Within a short time, there were 22 distilleries in Newport, all of them owned by Jews, manufacturing and distributing firewater.
Can I ask you something real quick? I don't mean to interrupt, but I had a thought here.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it a coincidence that most black people smoke Newport cigarettes that are full of chemicals that are probably killing them from Newport, right?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
I find that interesting. Yeah, go ahead, man. I'm sorry, dude.
I never thought of that.
Yeah.
The story of the debauching of the Indians with its resultant massacres of the early settlers is a dramatic story in itself. It is essential to comprehend the seaport of Newport. It is important in order to recognize the Jewish share in the slave commerce. There was a period when it was commonly referred to as the Jewish Newport World Center of Slave Commerce.
Wow.
Altogether, at this time, there were in North America six Jewish communities: Newport, Charleston, New York, Philadelphia, Richmond, and Savannah. Mm-hmm. There were also many other Jews scattered over the entire East Coast, although New York held first place in the settlers of Jews in North America. Newport held second place. New York was also the main source of kosher meat, supplying the North American settlements, then the West Indies, and also South America. Now, Newport took over after that. Newport also became the great trade harbor of the East Coast of North America. Their vessels from other ports met to exchange commodities. Newport, as previously mentioned, represented the foremost place in the commerce of rum, whiskey, and liquor dealings. And to conclude, it finally became the main center of slave dealings. It was from this port that the ships left on their way across the ocean to gather their black human cargo and then derive great sums of money in exchange for them. An authentic contemporary report based on authority indicates that of 128 ships, for instance, unloaded in Charleston within 1 year, 120 of these undersigned by Jews from Newport in Charleston by their own name, and the rest of them, one can surmise, although they entered as Boston, Norfolk, Baltimore, etc., the real owners were similarly the Jewish slave dealers from Newport and Charleston. One is able to assess the Jewish share in the entire dealings of Newport if one considers the undertaking of a lone Jew, the Portuguese Aaron Lopez, who played an important part in this all-over story of the Jews and slavery. Concerning the entire commerce of the colonies in the later state of Rhode Island, which includes Newport, bills of lading, concessions, receipts, port clearances carried the signature of the name of the Jew named Aaron Lopez. This all took place during the years 1726 to 1724. He had therefore more than 50% of all dealings under his personal control for almost 50 years. Aside from that, there were other ships which he owned but sailed under different names. In the year 1749, the first Masonic Lodge was established. 90% of the members of this first lodge there, 14 all told, were Jews. And one knows the only so-called prominent individual, had to go to the next page here, were prominent individuals were accepted. 20 years later, the second Masonic Lodge, King David, was established. It is a fact that all of these members were Jews. Now, these were lodges in Rhode Island, not the rest of the United States.
Mm-hmm. And there we see the beginning of the infiltration and the co-opting of Masonry, not because Masonry is Jewish, but because Masonry was the largest organization of the aristocrat establishment of this country, and they had to co-opt it and infiltrate it to then take over our government.
Yeah, I'm going to cover it a little more on that in my own show, but yeah, that's a very good point to go ahead and make. Mm-hmm. Let's see here. In the meantime, the Jewish influence in Newport had reached such proportions that President George Washington decided to pay them a visit. And this is what I was talking about earlier about there being a letter, because they wrote George Washington a letter, and it's at the bottom of this essay. But I won't read that. It says, upon his appearance, both of the Masonic lodges sent an emissary, a Jew named Moses Seixas. Okay, I know I didn't say that right, but I'm going to have to repeat that word over and over again.
It's actually Moses.
They sent this Jew to approach the president with a petition in which the Jews in Newport stated, if you will permit the children of Abraham to approach you with a request to tell you that we honor you and feel an alliance, and then, until the present time, the value rights of a free citizen have been withheld. However, now we see a government coming into being based on the majesty of the people, a government not sanctioning any bigotry nor persecution of the Jew, rather to concede the freedom of thought which each shares, whatever nation or language, is part of the great government machine. So you can see their intentions right there, what they had for this country. It is necessary at this point to consider the disclosure as to who in reality obtained this legendary freedom in America at the founding of the Union. To be sure, the province became independent and severed from English jurisdiction. However, we can see from the petition which this Moses guy, I'm going to use that phrase, offered President Washington in the name of the Jews of Newport, that it was not in reality this type of freedom which they had in mind. They were merely concerned about themselves and their own civil rights, which had been therefore withheld. Therefore, following the Revolutionary War, the Jews were accorded equal rights and freed all of the restrictions. And the Negroes? No. The Revolutionary War, notwithstanding, they remained slaves. In the year 1750, 1/6 of the population of New York was Negroid, And proportionally in the southern parts of the country, they outnumbered the others. But the proclamation of freedom did not touch them. A little bit more on this later. I would say this is a good time for a break.
Okay, sure, man. We're going to go to a break here. And I'm going to play a song here for all you gay skinheads and the Dick Hutts Clap Room. This is Faggo. Enjoy.
I'm back. Are you back, Mike?
I'm back. Sorry about that. Had a good
time. It's okay. Not a problem. Not a problem.
Welcome back, everybody. Let me just say this. Dave in Texas is my guest. This is Down and Out Radio. This is Mike Sledge. We're going to rip it up here. Second hour, if you're just tuning in, renegadebroadcasting.com. The chat room pops up. Everything is there. Renegadebroadcasting.com. Dave, go ahead. Let's get back into this, man.
Okay, one thing briefly first. You know, I had mentioned in the chat room a few days ago that I would be doing something on Martin Luther King for this show, but I changed my mind. I got to looking at what was involved and the detail to digging into it. I had the 60-page document on King that has just the absolute most disgusting dirt regarding this man. But it's just too exhaustive and extensive for the time that I had to get ready for this show. So I'm going to just put that off for a later time. So if any of you are expecting that, sorry. We'll catch up later on it. So
sure.
All righty. Well, anyway, back to where we were at. Let us follow the journey of one ship owner by a slave dealer named Aaron Lopez, which had made many trips to the African coast. For instance, in the month of May 1752, the ship Abigail, and many of you have probably heard that name, was equipped with about 9,000 gallons of rum, a great supply of iron foot and hand restraints, pistols, powder, sabers, and a lot of worthless tin ornaments. And under the command of a Jewish captain, Friedman sailed off for Africa.
Friedman Fly. He's running in a bus now.
There were but two mates and six sailors comprising the crew.
Mm-hmm.
3.5 months later, they landed on the African coast. Meanwhile, there had been constructed an African agency by Jewish slave dealers who had corralled them and prepared them for sale. This organization reached deep into Africa, had many ramifications, including the heads of groups, villages. This method was to win over the leaders for the Jewish slave trade, when it was similar to that which the Jews had employed with the Indians. At first, they presented them with rum and soon found themselves in an alcoholic delirium. When the gold dust and ivory supply was exhausted, they were induced to sell their descendants, at first their wives and then their youths. Then they began warfare amongst each other, plotted and developed mostly by the Jews. And if they captured prisoners, these too were exchanged for rum, ammunition, and weapons for the Jews, using them for further campaigns to capture more Negroes. The captured blacks were linked two by two and driven through the medieval forests to the coast. These painful treks required weeks, and some of them frequently became ill and felled by exhaustion, and many unable to rise, even though the bullwhip was applied as an encourager. They were left to die and were devoured by wild beasts. It was not unusual to see the bones of the dead laying in the tropical sun, a sad and gruesome reminder to those who would later tread on this path. It has been calculated that for each Negro who withstood the rigors of this wandering, there still had to be the long voyage across the ocean before they reached American soil. You know, let me say something here before I go any further. Only 10% of the whole slave trade came to the United States. 90% of it went to the Caribbean and South America. Okay, let me begin again on that sentence. It has been calculated that for each Negro who withstood the rigors of this wandering, there still had to be the long voyage across the ocean before they reached American soil. 9 out of 10 died. And when one considers that there was a yearly exodus of 1 million black slaves, then, and only then, can one assess the tremendous and extensive exodus of the African people. At present, Africa is thinly populated, and this is 1968 when he's writing it, not alone due to the 1 million literally dragged out of huts, but due to the 5 to 9 million who never reached their destination. Once they reached the coast, the black slaves were driven together, and restraints were applied to hold them into the next transport ship docked. The agents, many of them Jews, who represented the chief, then began the deal with the captain. Each Negro was personally presented to him, but the captains had learned to become suspicious. The black one must move his fingers, arms, legs, and the entire body to ensure that there were not any fractures. Even the teeth were examined. If a tooth was lacking, it lowered the price. And by the way, I want to throw something in here. Through most dealings in general with slaves, it was not uncommon for a slave dealer, if he had an older slave, to dye his hair to cover up the gray so he would appear younger.
Mm.
If a tooth was lacking, it lowered the price. Most of the Jew agents knew how to treat sick Negroes with chemicals in order to sell them as sound. Each Negro was valued at about 100 gallons of rum, 100 pounds of gunpowder, or in cash between $18 to $20.
Wow.
The notations of a captain inform us that on September 5th, 1763, one Negro brought as much as 200 gallons of rum due to the bidding amongst the agents, raising the price. Women under 25, pregnant or not, resulted in the same measure if they were well and comely. Any over 25 years old lost 25% of their value. And here it should be stated that Negroes purchased free at the African coast for $20 to $40 were then resold by the same slave dealers in America for $2,000.
Hmm.
This one gives an idea of how the Jews managed to acquire tremendous fortunes. Following the bargaining, Captain Friedman paid the bill either in merchandise or cash. He also recalls some sound advice which his Jewish employer gave him as he left Newport for Africa. Pour as much water into the rum as you can. In this manner, the Negro chiefs were cheated two times by the Newport Jews. Next page. The next step was to shave the hair from the head of the acquired slave. Then they were bound and branded with a hot iron, either on the back or the hip, identifying them with their owners. Now, the Negro slave was indeed the property of the Jewish purchaser. If he had fled, he could be identified. Following this procedure, there was a farewell celebration. There were instances where entire families were brought out of the interior to the coast and then separated through the bayou, father going with one ship, the son and daughters into another. These farewell celebrations were usually packed with emotion, tears, drama, and sadness. There was little joy, if ever. The following day, the transport began from land to ship. It was managed by taking 4 to 6 Negroes at one time in rowboats to the ships. Of course, the slave dealers were aware of how the Negro loved his homeland above all else and could only be induced by great force to leave it, so some of the Negroes would leap into the water. But here the overseers were prepared with sharp dogs and retrieved the fleeing men. Other Negroes preferred drowning. What came aboard alive was ultimately undressed. Here was another opportunity to jump overboard and reach land and freedom. But the slave dealers were pitiless and ruthless. They were merely concerned to get their black cargo to America with the least loss. Therefore, an escapee, recaptured, had both of his legs cut off before the eyes of the remaining Negroes.
Jeez.
In order to restore order.
Wow.
Yeah, that shows you just how cruel these people were. And it doesn't end there. On board the ship.
And by the way, the same tactics today, Dave, against the Palestinians, the same thing. They cut the baby's arms off, the legs off over there. It's disgusting, man. This is their MO, man, from the beginning. It's just the worst tyranny you've ever seen. And now we're all marked, numbered now. It's amazing. Go ahead, man.
On board the ship, the Negroes were separated into three groups. The men were placed in one part of the ship, the women into another, whereby the lusty captain arranged it so that the youngest, most comely Negro women were accessible to him. The children remained on deck, covered with the cloth in bad weather. In this fashion, the slave ship proceeded on its journey to America. In the main, the ships were too small and not at all suitable to transport people. They were barely equipped to transport animals, which the Negroes were likened to. In one space, 1 meter high, or approximately 39 inches, these unfortunate creatures were placed into a horizontal position, pressed close together. Mostly they were chained together. In this position, they had to remain for 3 months until the end of the voyage. Rarely was there a captain who sympathized with them or evidenced any feelings whatsoever for these pitiful creatures. Occasionally, they would be taken in groups to the deck for fresh air, shackled in irons. Somehow, these Negroes were expendable and endured much. On occasion, one of them became insane, killing the other one pressed closely to him. They also had their fingernails closely cut so they could not tear at each other's flesh. The most horrible battles came about among the men to acquire a centimeter or two of comfortable positions. It was then that the slave overseer stepped in with his bullwhip. The unimaginable, horrible human excrement in which these slaves had to endure these trips is impossible to describe. In the women's quarters, the same conditions prevailed. Women gave birth to children lying pressed closely together. The younger Negro women were constantly raped by the captain and the crew, resulting thereby in a new type of mulatto as they came to America. I want to interject something on that topic right there. A lot of times the mulattoes were used as domestic help, and they, because they were part white, they were considered to be more intelligent or more manageable or whatever the case may be. And the darker Negroes were left out in the fields to do the work. And they also, over the course of time through breeding, would take the largest men with the largest women and try to continually breed a larger Negro to be able to accomplish more work. And there was a man named Jimmy the Greek, a football broadcaster, who had brought up that issue once, and he never lived that down. They took him off the network for saying that, but he was describing black football players in this country with based on that. Okay, back
to
the
essay.
Very
accurate, by the way. It was,
yes,
it was actually
true,
very accurate.
But
yeah,
politically
absolutely
incorrect.
Right, right, right.
Let me light this cigarette. I'm smoking right where I'm at now. I don't care.
No, I don't care either. I'm going to smoke one, too.
In Virginia, or in any other southern port cities, the slaves were transferred to the land and immediately sold. A regular auction would take place following the method of purchase in Africa. The highest bidder obtained the ware. In many cases, due to the indescribable filth, some of the blacks became ill during the sea voyage from Africa to America. They became unemployable. In such cases, the captain accepted any price. It was rare to dispose of them, for no one wanted to purchase a sick Negro. Therefore, it is not surprising that the Jewish unethical doctor senses a new form of revenue. They purchased the sick Negro for a small sum, then treated him and sold him for a larger sum. On occasion, the captain would be left with a few Negroes from whom he did not find a buyer. In that case, he returned to Newport and sold them to the Jews for cheap domestic help. In other cases, the Jew owner of the ships took them over. This is why the city of Newport and its surroundings had 4,697 black slaves in the year 1756.
Okay.
Slavery did not extend to the North. Moreover, in many of the Northern American colonies, slavery was strictly forbidden. Of course, we're a little bit later in time in this here. Georgia had come under discussion, likewise also Philadelphia, and again it was the Jews who managed a loophole, which had given them freedom following the Revolutionary War. So they schemed to make slave trading illegal. Now, let me mention something here. Remember I said earlier that the Constitution that was set up to eliminate the slave trade, the importation of slaves, 20 years later, and that would have been 1808. Now, this is what this is talking about. The Jews kept on doing it, ignoring the law.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, there probably was really no way to stop them at the time either, unless somebody wanted to put out a big effort, but it was probably not to anybody else's advantage to do so, so they let it continue. And they just turned a blind eye. One had but to read the names of those persons living in Philadelphia who were requesting the elimination of existing laws regarding the slavery dealing. They were the Jews Sandifer, Lay, Woolman, Solomon, and Benezet. That explained it all. Let us turn back to the slave ship Abigail. Its captain, and we are reading from this ship's books, did a profitable business. He sold all of his Negroes in Virginia, invested some of his money in tobacco, rice, sugar, and cotton, and went on to Newport, where he deposited his wares. We learn from the Captain Friedman's book of the Abigail that it was a small ship and could only accommodate 56 people. He managed, however, to clear from one trip $6,621, which he in turn delivered to the owner of the ship, one Aaron Lopez. The staggering amounts of money acquired by the Jew ship owners and slavery dealers is better illustrated when we emphasize the many years in which the sale and purchase of human flesh was practiced. Prior to 1661, all of the colonies had laws prohibiting slavery. It was in that year that the Jews had become powerful enough to bring about the repeal of these laws, and slavery began in earnest. The Jews had discovered that the colonists needed additional manpower to help them clear their fields for planting, helping in the construction of dwellings, and in general, help with harvesting their crops. This was particularly true of the southern states, which we have referred to earlier. The Southerners had vast tracts of rich soil suitable for rice, cotton, tobacco, and cane sugar. At first, impoverished Europeans were recruited. English prison doors were opened, and finally prisoners of war from England and Holland were brought to the colonies, made to work until they had paid the cost of transporting them by ship and then set free. It doesn't take a Jew long to discover what his brothers are doing. So a group of Jews settled in Charleston, South Carolina, where they set up distilleries for making rum and whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
They, too, learned that they could trade with the natives on the west coast of Africa for ivory, and several ships were purchased and sent to Africa, trading the usual glass beads and other cheap ornaments for ivory, which, however, took up a little space on board the ship. It occurred to the Jew traders they could supply the plantations in the south with black ivory needed under swampy and malarial conditions, which mm-hmm. European labor could not tolerate without sickness, and which would not only fill the holds of their ships, but bring enormous profits. This same group had earlier tried selling Indians as slaves, but they found them completely unsatisfactory, as the Indians would not tolerate this kind of work. Thus, another segment of the slave trading had become active and profitable out of Charleston, South Carolina. Several shiploads of black slaves were sent by the Dutch West Indies Company to Manhattan. During this time, there were a number of plantation owners established in the West Indies, and two Jews, Erger and Sayer, whatever, however you pronounce it, with strong Rothschild connections in Spain,
yep.
formed an agency called Asiento, which later operated in Holland and England. It was through those connections that Jews in Holland and England exerted influence, and both of these connections cooperating in helping the Jews provide black slaves for the colonists. And that's, if you've ever heard the remark made by Bismarck in Germany about how the war between the states was ultimately set up by the Rothschilds, there's
yep.
your source right there.
Absolutely. And then again, after they completed that, then they moved on to Germany to deconstruct that. It's very interesting. Very, very interesting. Yep.
With the yearly capture and transport of 1 million black slaves, it is not difficult to figure that from 1661 to 1774, and that's 130 years, approximately 110 million slaves had been removed from their native land. About 10%, or 11 million black slaves, reached the colonies alive. Now, you can figure how many died along the way, and et cetera. We have talked about this small ship, Abigail, which could accommodate only 56 people, and yet the profits per trip were enormous, with little or no investment. There were many other ships, but we will concentrate here on only a few, such as the La Fortuna, the Hanna, the Sally, or the Venue, which made very great profits. The La Fortuna, by the way, transported approximately 217 slaves on each trip. Now compare that to 56. The owner cleared not less than $41,438 from such a trip. Now, you know what that is today. What was that then? Okay. These were dollars which the slave owners could keep, and these were dollars of value which would buy a great deal in return. When one considers the Jews of Newport owned about 300 slave transporting ships active without interruption, docking at Newport, Africa, Charleston, or Virginia, one can approximate the tremendous earnings which made their way to Jewish ship owners. Indeed, the Jews admit that of 600 ships leaving Newport Harbor into all of the world, at least half of them went their way to Africa. And we know that these ships going to Africa, what they were seeking. The fact that Aaron Lopez had control over more than half of the combined deals in the colonies of Rhode Island with Newport is well known. The well-known Rabbi Morris A. Gutstein, in his book, The Story of the Jews in Newport, attempts to remove these facts, maintaining that there is not any evidence that the Jews were connected with the slave trade. It is therefore imperative to prove the Jew was indeed connected with the slave trade, especially so since the rabbi insists that they had made great contributions and how very blessed their residence became for the city of Newport. Surely Morris A. Gutstein will grant us permission to present the facts which he was unable to find. Turning to one report of the Chamber of Commerce of the Rhode Island Colony in the year 1764, we find, for instance, that in the year 1723, a few merchants in Newport devised the idea to send their Newport rum to the coast of Africa. It developed into such great export that in the matter of a few years, several thousand hogsheads of rum went that way. To which purpose did this rum serve, you may ask? The Carnegie Institute in Washington, D.C. presents and makes public authentic documents entitled Documents Illustrative of the History of the Slave Trade in America. We wish to present a few facts from this particular collection of original documents and scrutinize them at closer range, and not at all to prove the heretofore Rabbi Morris A. Gutstein in error. In this collection of American Institute of Learning, we evaluate the capital Rhode Island, which contributed the main share of the public documentation regarding the slave trading. Here we find documented the recipients of the numerous shipping letters, also letters to the slave dealers, and correspondence to the ship's captains, who were about 15% Jews living in Newport. Among these we find, for instance, the Jew Isaac Eleazar. He wrote a letter to Captain Christopher Chaplin on February 6, 1763, saying he would like to be an agent for a load of slaves. Then follows the Jew Abraham Pereira Mendez and one of the main slave dealers, a Jacob Rod Rivera, the father-in-law of Aaron Lopez. And then there is Aaron Lopez himself and many, many other Jews. Although we have considered Aaron Lopez several times, the size of this documented treatise limits us, and we cannot describe all of the writers concerned in the slavery-dealing correspondence, their names, and the special dates. Rather, we wish to study the documentation of the Carnegie Institute itself, keeping Aaron Lopez in mind. We wish to see that, in the main, this Jew was pursuing and what his business was. This is due to the fact that Robert Morris A. Gutstein presents himself as a lofty and fine civilian of Newport, who was so generous and even made contributions to welfare. Let me take a little swig of my drink here.
Yeah, actually, Dave, we have a call here online. You want to take that while you take a swig there and maybe take a break?
Okay.
You're interested?
Sure.
If you don't want to, we don't have to.
Well, go ahead and take it.
Okay, 608. We'll go live.
Hey, good
here.
Evening.
608. Yes.
Hey, yeah, I was just listening. I don't have anything cogent to add at the moment. Kind of drunk. But yeah, it's just disgusting, you know. I'm enjoying the show though. David, are you reading from a book or I just tuned in?
It's a little small booklet that was published in the late '60s about the slave trade. I made a PDF file of it, and with all the references and a letter at the bottom of it. It's about 14 pages. I'm on page 8 of that 14 right now.
Okay, well, yeah, you could just mute me again. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, have a good time. Later. All right, Dave, go for him.
Okay, let's see here. Let me scroll down a little further. I know some of this is kind of hard to follow, and I'm not obviously the best reader in the world, but I'm doing my best.
You're doing good, Dave.
Well, you know, this is really the only way that you can convey this information properly. I mean, you know, you can sit here and say this, that, and the other, but, you know, you're not really backing it up. You know, this is really backing it up with detail, you know.
Right.
And we do research, and all of us do pretty good research, and we try to be as accurate as we can. But, you know, and it's not always possible to convey the details of the research that we've learned. But this is particularly important. And this is something that really just needs to be reinforced because we know how we got to this point was very, very unsavory. But these are the details of that unsavoriness.
Right.
So, Now, let's see, where was I at? In a great number of published original unprejudiced writings in the Carnegie Institute, we find that Aaron Lopez pursued a tremendous commerce in rum with the African coast in exchange for slaves. Let's see here. Let me scroll. Oops, went too far. These are some sample letters, and I'm not going to go through all of them. Just mm-hmm. cite some examples. Some of these letters are from like 1764, 65, 66, 67. The letter from one captain to another, and it's they were all to an Aaron Lopez or a Nathaniel Briggs or a Captain Abraham Hall. And these are this is just evidence and samples of what this book is describing. Okay, aside from that, there are similar statements out of letters by Aaron Lopez in the original, which he directed to the captains Henry Kruger, David Mill, Henry White, Thomas Dolbear, and William Moore.
Dave.
Yes.
Okay, you're back. Go ahead, man. This is hog talk for a second. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Indeed, one letter by Captain William Moore to Aaron Lopez and company is particularly revealing. In a special mention at this point, we wish to remark on the main contents of this letter, which Captain Moore writes. I wish to advise you that your ship, named Anne, docked here tonight before last with 112 slaves, consists of 35 men, 16 large youths, 21 small boys, 29 women, two grown girls, and 9 small girls. And I assure you, this is such a one rum cargo, basically rum in exchange for slaves, which I have not yet encountered. Among the entire group, there may be 5 to which one could take exception. The date of the above letter was November 1773. We have not yet concluded, because of the lack of space, the excerpts and grateful compilations made available by the Carnegie Institute. Now see, so that's the kind of letters that the Carnegie Institute has on file. They're sitting there telling you, this number of youth, this number of men, this number of women, and what they are talking about. So, I mean, this is direct evidence. This is not something written down in some history book somewhere. This is on file, okay?
Right.
In November 29, 1767, the Jew Abraham Mendez, who had been cheated by one of his own kind from Charleston, where he had journeyed to better control his black cargo, wrote Aaron Lopez at Newport, "These Negroes, which Captain Abraham all delivered to me, were in such poor condition due to the transportation that I was forced to sell 8 boys and girls for a mere £27, 2 for £45, and 2 women each for £35. No doubt this is English money, of course. So you can see right there they're even bitching at each other for screwing each other. And you know what the cargo was. Abraham Mendez is very angry and accused Aaron Lopez of cheating him. This letter delineates to us that this generous and fine citizen of Newport was insatiable in his greed for money. This is what caused Rabbi Morris Gutstein to present his nobleman, Aaron Lopez, to pursue his objectionable methods. Negroes presented to him but a commodity." Okay, let me go down a little more. I may skip some of this.
Sure, man.
Let me take a quick glance at it. Now I'll read this paragraph. "In all of the letters which the Carnegie Institute published, it stressed the lack of human sympathy for the poor Negro slaves. This lack of feeling and compassion for the abused and pitiful blacks at the hands of their Jewish dealers can be read out of the diary of a captain who manned a ship owned by Aaron Lopez. The entrees concern a trip from the African coast to Charleston. Moreover, they are authentic documents published by the Carnegie Institute in Washington, D.C., calling attention to an organization which had...
It'll come back in a second here.
Which had heretofore known little or nothing about, neither had they encountered further publicity in books or newspapers. Therefore, it is not to be wondered at the facts of the leading share of the American Jews in the slave trade could be pointed out as a monopoly and unknown to the non-Jewish Americans, including the great masses of people all over the world. Others, however, acquainted with the facts, had good reason to remain painfully quiet." Let me scroll, next page. here's a list of how some of the Negroes were died, as documented. One woman dead with fever, another one died with something called flux, no doubt some illness. Two women went overboard because they had not been locked up. One girl, sick for 2 months, died. So this isn't a sample of the documentation. This vessel was on its way for 5 months. What terrible and unspeakable suffering was the lot of these millions of blacks who were torn with brutal force from their friendly African huts, jammed together like animals below deck, and then sold with less concern than selling a head of cattle. Small wonder that 10 of them died, being purchased for just a few dollars and then sold for the sum of $2,000. Some Negroes managed through insurrection to gain control of one or another ship and turned it around with full sails toward their African home. The crew of one slave ship, 300, called 300 Friends, for instance, tortured their black cargo in such a manner that the Negroes reciprocated in a bloody rebellion. They killed the captain and the entire crew and threw the dead overboard. Then they sailed back to Africa, where they had barely escaped their hard-won freedom. A similar fate struck the slave ship Amistad. Among the slaves was the son of an enemy tribal chief. He schemed with his compatriots to attack the ship's crew. Once the ship was underway, following a bloody battle, they managed to capture the captain. The Negro prince forced him to turn back to Africa. Then in the evening, under the cover of darkness, he changed his course, zigzagged for months until he came close to the American coast and encountered a government ship. This took place in the year 1839, when slave trading was already forbidden and illegal. So the Negro slaves were freed, and the I just lost my place. Hold on.
While you're looking for your place here, let me say Amistad. That was the Oprah Winfrey paid-for movie, one of her first movie projects she came out with on her own. Out of the Chicago school of communist Jewish influence there, financed that. It's like Obama's control of the Chicago school. So we see the Chicago syndicate consolidation there. Amistad came out in the late 90s as one of her first big independent movies paid for with Chicago Jew money. Very interesting. And she rewrote that whole history, by the way.
Sounds like it.
Yep, yep.
Okay, the Negro slaves were freed and the captain punished. These sea voyages were not without danger when they had black cargo, which accounts for the fact that the Jews must always engage non-Jewish captains. They hired the Goy to do their dirty work. The slave dealers preferred to remain in their offices and counted the fat winnings following each journey, such as Aaron Lopez, who left his heirs one of the largest fortunes in the New England area. When reviewing the documented facts contained herein, it is important that one always remembers that it was a lucky captain who did not lose more than 9 out of 19 slaves on the return trip. It is equally important to remember that these poor black creatures had to lie in human excrement for the entire trip. Think of it. No wonder sickness and disease took such a high toll. Remember these figures. Approximately 110 million black people were captured and removed from their homeland in Africa. Only 11 million of these black slaves reached the colonies alive. The Carnegie Institute of Technology is located in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm going to give you a list of the Jewish ships here that they have on documentation. And most of you may have already heard this, but I'll run through them again. The name should sound familiar if you've heard them before. The Abigail, owned by Aaron Lopez, as well as Moses Levy and Jacob Franks. The Crown was owned by Isaac Levy and Nathan Simpson. The Nassau was owned by Moses Levy. The Four Sisters was owned by Moses Levy. The Anne and Eliza was owned by Justice Bosch and John Abrams. The Prudent The Prudent Betty was owned by Henry Kruger and Jacob Phoenix. The Hester was owned by Mordecai and David Gomez. The Elizabeth was owned by David and Mordecai Gomez. The Antigua or Antiwa, however way you want to pronounce it, was owned by Nathan Marston and Abram Lyell. The Betsy was owned by a William DeWolf. And another ship that I can't pronounce was owned by that same man, the Poui, or Poui, P-O-U-I.
It's that's what you said.
Yeah. And then the White Horse was owned by Jean S-W-E-E-V-T-S.
Jean.
The Expedition was owned by John and Jacob Roosevelt. The Charlotte was owned by Moses
Roosevelt.
And Sam.
Interesting,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. The Charlotte was owned by Moses and Sam Levy and Jacob Franks. The Caracoa was owned by Moses and Sam Levy in the list. The slave runners also owned by Jews were the La Fortuna, the Hannah, the Sally, and the Venue. Some of these Jews of Newport and Charleston.
Dave, you still there?
Yeah.
You're back. Okay.
What's that?
Oh, you dropped off and I was doing that. Just make sure you came back. Okay.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, I don't know why I'm dropping off. But
it's the Jews.
Well, they don't like this information getting out, I'm sure. But, you know.
Yeah.
We can't blame them for every time this thing happens. But
I know. Especially just a bad connection. Cheap-ass network.
Okay. Well, anyway, now I know why you're doing that. So, some of the Jews of Newport and Charleston who were engaged in the distillery or in distillery or slavery. Okay, let me start over. Some of the Jews of Newport and Charleston who were engaged in the distillery or slavery trade or both were Isaac Gomez, Haman Levy, Jacob Mahado, Naftali. I can't even pronounce it. Myers, David Hart, Joseph Jacobs, Moses Ben Franks, Moses Gomez, Isaac Dias, and Benjamin Levy. Next page. David Jesuvum, Jacob Pinto, Jacob Turk, David Gomez, James Lacuna. There's that Jean de again. Felix de Souza, Simeon Potter, Isaac Elizer, or Elazar, Jacob Rod, someone named Rivera, Haim, Isaac
Rivera.
Yeah, Abram Turo, Moses Hayes, Moses Lopez, Judah Turo, Abraham Mendez, and Abraham Hall. Okay, now, we have your names documented. All right, there we go. Of some 600 ships leaving the port of Newport, more than 300 were engaged in the slave trade. A typical cargo of one ship called the La Fortuna was 217 slaves, which cost $4,300 and sold for $41,438. That's a repeat of info from earlier. Only about 10% of the slave ship captains were Jews, not wanting to subject themselves to the rigors of the six-month journey. Okay, that pretty much ends that, and the rest is documentation and then a letter that was sent from a Jewish Masonic lodge to George Washington, but I don't really consider the contents of the letter necessary. All it's really doing is basically saying, thank you for giving us the freedom to do this.
Right.
So where are we at on time here? 8:38, we got about 20 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
Put your 2 cents in, Mike. Let's hear it.
Basically it's this, that the Jews ran the slave trade. They profited off of it. As a matter of fact, why do you think the cotton industry was so key to the slave industry? Levi Strauss, jeans, right? I mean, let's be honest here. Jewish jeans, Jew jeans, is what I call them. All that came about through the cotton industry, the slave trade, taking over the plantations of the South, displacing white working class people before they brought over the African slaves. We see in Charleston, South Carolina, the influx, Rhode Island, like you said, New Orleans. We also see Savannah here in Georgia, where I live. Yeah.
Natchez,
Mississippi. And see, what they did was, and that goes back to the Jewish Hollywood propaganda. You remember the movie Mississippi Burning?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what did they do there? They tried to demonize the Gentile slave, the Gentile plantations, and the Gentile old money aristocracy as being behind the racist attack, civil rights workers, and so forth. I said, you know, that I believe that some of the attacks on the civil rights workers were perpetrated by the same people who controlled the civil rights movement. There's a lot of talk about false flags, about blowing black churches in Alabama. I don't believe it was done by real Southerners. That was part, you know, I believe that was done by their own group to bring in, to try to raise sentiment against anybody trying to stand up for rights, to the communist civil rights movement, infiltration of our culture and society. I do believe that. And
I
so you see that? Yeah, yeah.
And go ahead. I've been talking. I don't want to talk anymore if I don't have to.
Well, you see that as being the extension of, you see, their whole deal was you see, they, most of the slaves came in through Rhode Island in the north, right?
Well, the trade, the trade was run through there.
Right, right, right. And so now you see they knew this was going to be unpopular, and they didn't need to continue with that because the north had different means of money coming in through a Rothschild banking family to destroy the South. So they put Abraham G. Lincoln up, okay, and they ran the propaganda they were trying to stop slavery. In reality, they were trying to break up the South, okay, to destroy the economy there, to loot it, and then to blame slavery on the group of people that had nothing to do with it so they could protect themselves, to bring in a federalization of the government, which we didn't have before, which would then benefit slavery in the long run by corporate law. And corporate law was brought soon after the Civil War through the railroad legislation to the Supreme Court. So we see the pattern here, okay? It was not an accident. And I think they realized that they could, through the concept of corporation, they could bring in slavery through a different means. And then they knew when they went to the civil rights movement in the 60s that they were going to move to the second phase of the Chicago School of Jewish Economics and bring in free trade, and they could then transport the slavery from out of this country into Indonesia, Central America, South America, the Philippines, etc., turn the world into their global slave operation, and use slave labor in different places, in different enclaves that would be tax-free, where they could then benefit the huge corporations and hide behind a veil of a protection through their Jewish-controlled media.
The best slave is a slave who can feed and house and what was the words I was looking for? The best slave is one who can feed himself, clothe himself, and house himself. That's what I was
right.
looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and what's interesting here, folks, is that, you know, we see history is so important because it does connect to modern times. Let's look at the slave trade. Most of the white Southerners were against the slave trade because it displaced their jobs on plantations, okay? Most, just like most of the blue-collar workers in this country were opposed to NAFTA and other free trade agreements because it would displace them and bring in a new slave labor. So these Jewish-controlled entities always find new ways and new forms of slavery, and they keep on hiding behind their false morality and their media control to portray themselves as the good guys, when in fact they are the real enslavers. The ones that fight for civil rights, folks, are the ones that want to enslave you, okay? And the people that they demonize as being anti-humanity are really have more humanism in their minds than the ones that say they do. And this is very important. It's always the opposite with these bastards, man. Always the opposite.
They will always portray themselves as the good guys and the victim.
Yep, absolutely. Always the victim status, Dave.
Now, my line has been breaking up through a good portion of what you were talking about there, but I caught most of it, and I moved my cord around. I don't know if that has anything to do with it or not, but I caught most of what you were saying. But I'm hoping I'm not breaking up on the other end. Am I coming through clear?
But you sound great, man. You sound great.
Okay, good. All right. Go ahead on. Maybe you want to take calls, too, if you like.
Well, actually, I have a special surprise. Well, actually, I do have a call. That's the same guy on hold. Actually, I have a surprise thing here if you want me to play it. It's a special new advertiser.
Okay.
Is that cool with you?
It's your show, dude.
I think you'll like this, Dave. Check this out, all right?
Hold on, little girl. Show me what he done to you. Stand up, little girl. A broken heart can't be that bad. When it's through, it's through. Fake the twist of both of you. Come on, baby.
Hey, everybody, this is Charles Giuliani from the Dick Hutt Show. Valentine's Day is around the corner, and you might want to get your sweetheart one of these great gifts. I got books, Piercing the Fag at 9/11. I got big chocolate balls, herbal teas, Killshire Farms Yard of Beef. I also got new products like Herbal Colon Cleanse. We call it Faggot Juice. It gets rid of anal warts, chlamydia, the clap. For all you gay skinheads in the Dick Hutt's clap room, I got big chocolate balls. I got herbal teas. So you can check this all out at Amazon.com. And my name, Charles Giuliani. That's Charles J-E-W Liani. And check out the Best of Charles Giuliani album, Golden Showers of Aw Shit. It proves how the Jews want to rule the world with an iron fisting. All you ladies out there who are getting jealous because all you gay skinhead husbands are spending too much time in the man cave of the Dick Cut Scat Room, we got Chocolate Log, we got Susan Puzzle Douche to use after the big chocolate log to get rid of those Linda semen stains from your inadequate performance. We got a Cankle Blaster, herbal tea. I got faggot juice.
Let me be the one to show.
And right now, the Dick Hutt Scat Room Valentine's Gay Special for $69.99. You get my new book, Red Hot, exposing how it's red hot to hang out with gay skinheads in the Dick Hutt's clap room. Big chocolate balls. We got hike sticks. When you're taking a hike through the rainforest, you sit around the bonfire with your butt buddies drinking Caroline Jaeger bombs. We got herbal teas, faggot juice. Just like my previous book, Piercing the Fag at 9/11, my new Valentine's Gay book, Red Hot, exposes the true origins of Valentine's Day. The Jews! You got it. So go to Scamazon.com and look up my name, Charles Giuliani. That's Charles J-E-W Liani. And tell him that Dick Hutt sent you.
I'm the one who wants to be with you.
I'm the one.
Deep inside, I hope you'll feel it too.
Feel it too, too.
Waiting on the light of
waiting on the light.
Yeah, just to be the next to be with you. I'm the one who wants
I'm
to
the one
be with you. Deep inside, I hope you.
sponsor for Valentine's Day, Dave.
Quite interesting. Actually, I don't know if you know it or not, but that got airplay late last night.
Oh, really? Oh, damn. I thought I was bringing it on.
There's one other thing I wanted to mention about this topic. Actually, there's two. Number one, I want to go ahead and give everybody the name of this book that I just read to them in case they want to do a search on the net to try and find it. It's called Who Brought the Slaves to America? And it was written by a man named Walter White, Jr. in 1968. And what I wanted to mention, too, was about slaves owned by Southern whites who were not tied in with any sort of plantation system.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say that most whites owned slaves. I would say that only, you know, according to the records, it was a very small number of people in the South, period, who even owned any kind of slave. But a lot of the whites who did own a slave maybe owned only like one or two. And a lot of times the slave was basically part of the family. Everybody would eat at the same table, and when the day began, everybody went out into the fields, and they did their work. The master was right there working right next to the slave. And at the time, the only way to run a farm was to either hire people, have slaves, or make your own children. And that's why you had so many families that were large, in particular the South. And that even went into well into the 20th century. My father grew up on a farm in Deep East Texas, and he was one of 10 children. And later on, when he got to be a teenager, they moved to the city. But, you know, that's how you got by. You had to have hands to work. And that was there was only about three choices that you had to do it. So,
right.
And obviously the slaves that were in the conditions of living with whites like that, I mean, I'm sure they slept in separate quarters. Okay, don't get me wrong, they didn't sleep in the same house, but they were treated very well. I mean, you know, what advantage would you have by beating your slave, whipping your slave? You know, if you're going to expect him to come out the next day and go to work with you, you're defeating your own purpose by doing that. And so there were instances where slaves were mistreated in the South, but it was not a regular thing. When the big push for abolition occurred from the North, they took a story out of a newspaper in the South where it had been reported that a slave had been beaten real bad, and they created this pamphlet, and they tried to make it as if that was the everyday condition. And the reason I'm saying this is that we know how the Jews treated the slaves when they brought them over here.
Right.
But once they got here, depending on where they were at, they were not always treated badly. Now, of course, if you're a slave, you know, how can you say you're being treated good? But at the same time, the view was taken by a lot of Southern whites that they were better off here than they were in Africa.
Well, they were treated worse there.
By Jews, they were, for sure.
Yeah, they were going to look at today, right now, Dave, Liberia, you know?
Well, Liberia was actually a colony created by the United States where they were intending to send them back. And had Lincoln not been shot, that may have happened because that was his goal. And I'm not going to say Lincoln was a good guy, but that's just a fact. So
yep.
And you know, also too, not everywhere in the South were there plantations. I mean, there were almost every state had at least some, but the highest concentration were in the Natchez area. That would go into Louisiana and Mississippi, and then certainly over in South Carolina and Georgia. And in Virginia, there were, you know, obviously a lot in Alabama. But like Tennessee probably did not have that many. I mean, the terrain probably didn't allow for it. It was the most southern states that really had the greatest benefit from slavery because of the climate. The hot and humid climate allowed for it. And that's why when the beginning of the secession crisis, there was only seven states that originally left the Union, and that was the lower seven states in the Confederacy. South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas, and not necessarily in that order. Although South Carolina was first and Texas was last. Now, I can tell you from studying Texas history that there were some plantations here, but there were not many, and the most famous one does have a Jewish name.
There you go.
We know who ultimately was to blame here for all this, and had they were never been brought over here, there's no telling how the course of history might have gone. You know, we can play what if all night. So,
well, Dave, we're coming to the end of the show here. Dave from Texas was my guest tonight, and I encourage everybody to listen to the archives, download this. Very important information. As always, Dave, a masterful job. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
And I want to say he's coming to Renegade Broadcasting on Sunday nights, the Dave from Texas show. Also, listen to all the great programming on Renegade, folks. We got Kyle Hunt every Monday with the Blitzkrieg broadcast. Tuesday, John Preston, great show. Wednesday, Greg from New Jersey. Me on Thursday nights. Fridays, I think I'm hearing something about Crawdad coming or something. Saturdays, Knights of the Roundtable. Sunday's coming up soon. Dave from Texas. Dave, thanks for coming on. As always, you're always welcome here. I can't wait for when your show starts. It's going to be very important for information for the network, man.
Thank you. Welcome.
And I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I'm going to end it with this song right here, baby. I hate commie scum.